And we'll reconvene later this afternoon in 1:30 Simrall to have the exam. I will email the exam to the proctors during the in-class exam, so most of you seem like you'll be taking it over the weekend or in the following week. I'll try to get the in-class exams graded over the weekend and returned on Monday. So what we're talking about now is how to estimate the density function in a sort of data-driven approach. And we've talked about two classes of approaches. One where we define the volume and let the volume then essentially vary as n goes to infinity. Or another where we define the number of points in the volume and then let the volume vary in size to encapsulate that number of points. The former method resulted in a technique we called Parsons window estimation, and the latter technique is what we're talking about today, which resulted in the kth-n nearest neighbor approach. So we talked a little bit about the k-nearest neighbor approach, the general properties of it. We want the number of data points within the cell to be constant, and we do that by choosing the cell size to be proportional to 1 over the square root of the number of points. And then we began talking about the nearest neighbor rule. So let d sub n be a sequence of measurements, x1 through xn. These are labeled prototypes. We know the class assignments for these. Let's let x primed be a member of d sub n and be the closest prototype to a test point x. The nearest neighbor rule for classifying x is simple. It's to assign it the label associated with x prime. So all we're going to do is, within our training set, if you will, our set of prototypes for which we know the labels, we're going to find the prototype closest to the test point, and then we are going to declare the class assignment of the test point as the class assignment of the closest training or labeled point. You can show, there's an extended derivation in the textbook. We won't go through it in class, but you can show that the nearest neighbor rule leads to an error rate greater than the minimum possible, the Bayes error rate. However, if the number of prototypes is large, the error rate of the nearest neighbor classifier is never worse than twice the Bayes error rate. So it's not a bad way to go, it's just not an optimal way to go. If n goes to infinity, it's always possible to find x prime sufficiently close so that this prototype produces what's called a Voronoi tessellation of the space, and the individual decision regions are called Voronoi cells. That's essentially, we've shown, showing that in two dimensions and three dimensions. You can sort of think of the nearest neighbor approach as simply partitioning the space based on the labeled prototypes. So it essentially creates a what we call this tessellation-type decision surface, because you've got lots of little cells that are essentially found by drawing the region for which all points within the cell are closest to this data point. And if you do that for all the labeled data points, then you get some kind of complicated surface. But the actual classification algorithm is simple, because you're just going to compute Euclidean distances between the test points and all the labeled prototypes, and then just choose the class of the closest labeled data point. For large data sets, this approach can be very effective, but it's not necessarily computationally efficient. Now, we can modify the nearest neighbor rule where the class assignment belongs to the class assignment of the closest vector. If you think about that long enough, you might say, well, we can come up with the k-nearest neighbor rule, which is a straightforward modification that builds on the concept of majority voting. Rather than allow only one labeled prototype to determine the class assignment, you can make things a little more robust in the event that perhaps that single point happens to be mislabeled, or it's anomalous, or it's not typical. So you can, in fact, look at a majority vote of points within the region of the test point. So the query starts at the data point X, and grows a spherical region until it encloses K training samples. The point is labeled by a majority vote of the class assignments for the K sample. So we show that in the graphic here. We have a data point X, and we then define a sphere that encapsulates K nearest labeled data points. And then we simply take as the class assignment the majority vote of these labeled data points. So if they're you look at the class assignments and decide the overall class assignment based on the class assignment which is most common amongst the points within that sphere. For very large data sets, the performance of the k-nearest neighbor rule approaches the Bayes error rate. So this is a very powerful algorithm. And in fact, it works pretty well. Years ago in this course, I used to do a little data competition at the end of the semester. I'd give the students some blind data and ask them to build an algorithm to train on some data and then evaluate on some blind data. And that data is actually available online on the course site. And invariably, the k-nearest neighbor rule was one of the winning algorithms because it's so easy to program and it does pretty well. And some of the other algorithms require more training data. So it can be a very powerful algorithm. The computational complexity of this approach, however, is high because each distance calculation is of order O of D, where D is the dimension of the input vector. And thus, the search is going to be O of D n squared, where n is the number of test vectors, because you have to find the k closest test vector. So you're going to have to search all the training vectors. So you're going to have to search all the training vectors to find those k closest vectors. However, a parallel implementation exists that is order O of 1 in time and O of n in space. We won't talk about that today, but you can imagine that this is something that's easily done in parallel. And alternately, tree-structured searches can gain further efficiency. You can actually try to sort the data so that you know how the various data points relate to one another, which ones are close, and then when you're going through this process of finding the k closest vectors, you sort of search down the tree and you observe, well, if this vector is close, then this vector will also be close. So you don't need to do the two distance computations because you've already pre-computed the fact that these two data points are close. Further, the training set, when you do this kind of tree-structured search, you can then do pruning on the tree. When data points, if you think about the data being sorted as those that are close and those that are not close, once you've determined one of these points is not close, you can then essentially ignore all the points in that neighborhood as also being not close. So you can save a lot of computations by doing this kind of tree-structured search and eliminating prototypes that have very low very large distances or low probabilities. And the tree-structured search, the complexity is O of D cubed, N to the D over 2, times the log of N. So it's not quite N squared or N cubed. It's more like N log N type complexity. Square root of n log n. So it's much faster. There are other approaches that people have looked at over the years to do this kind of k-nearest neighbor type classification, including some techniques based on neural networks that make it run much faster. And if you're willing to allow a little bit of error, if you're willing to accept an approximate solution, you can actually speed it up pretty significantly. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about Parsons window, nearest neighbor, and k-nearest neighbor. Three approaches based on this concept of probability density estimation. Now, at the core of all these algorithms is the concept of a distance metric. So I wanted to say a couple things about what a distance metric is and what properties should it obey. So when you're dealing with any kind of nearest neighbor rule, any kind of pattern recognition algorithm, very frequently you have a need to compute a measure of distance in some space. And distance measures, there are many forms of them, but they all generally obey a certain set of properties to be useful to us. And these are some of the properties. So the first property that we would like to be true is that the distance between A and B is non-negative. It's always greater than or equal to zero. And that, obviously, something like Euclidean distance satisfies that constraint. We'd also like the reflexivity property to hold, which states that if the distance between A and B is equal to zero, A is equal to B. And that's that seems very reasonable, but you can imagine complex problems where that's not the case. But we would like distance measures to obey that property. We'd also like them to obey symmetry. The distance between A and B is equal to the distance between B and A. If you remember back in your electromagnetics days, those of you who are electrical engineers, you talked about things like conservative electric magnetic fields. And this is a property that's very much analogous to this. This sort of says that whether you, if you think about the process of walking from this room to the post office, you would like the distance from this here to the post office to be the same no matter how you got there. And that's essentially what this property says. We also would like the, and it also, you could say, says that when you walk from here to the post office, you get the same distance as when you walk from the post office to here. And you may think that's trivial, but if you think about when you climb up a mountain and then you walk down a mountain, you could swear the distance is longer when you climb up the mountain. There's some interesting analogs of this in the real world, but obviously distance metrics like Euclidean distances obey these. The triangle inequality is also very important. This says that the distance between A and B plus the distance between B and C must be greater than or equal to the distance between A and C. What is an example of that from geometry? Where have you seen that property in geometry? It's known as a very kind of famous theorem or property or... Right, a triangle, which is the hypotenuse. Who's responsible for the hypotenuse theorem? Pythagorean theorem. Thank you. That the distance of the long side of a triangle is equal to the sum of the squares of the square root of the sum of the squares of the sides. Now, so from these, we can then deduce the Euclidean distance, which is simply the sum from k equals 1 to d of the element by element square distances. So we take each element of the vector A, each element of the vector B, we difference them, square them, and sum them up, and then take the square root. That's the Euclidean distance. It's related to the triangle inequality and the Pythagorean theorem. But this is not necessarily the only distance measure that we could use. In fact, if you think about our principal components problem, if you remember when we were talking about principal components, in the original data space, we discussed that if you compute a Euclidean distance between two points in the original feature space, what do we know about that distance? That distance is dominated by what? By the larger variances, right? Because we have the sum of the squares here. So if the scale of component number one, if the variance of that direction is much larger than the variance of the other directions, it's going to swamp the overall distance calculation. So we talked about principal components analysis as a way of transforming the data into a space where Euclidean distances were more meaningful because all directions in that transformed space had equal variances. The Minkowski metric is a generalization of the Euclidean distance, and this is defined as capital L sub k of A and B And this is defined as the sum of the absolute values of ak minus bk raised to the kth power, and then that sum raised to the 1 over kth power. And this is also referred to as the L sub k norm. The L1 norm, which would simply be the sum of the absolute values, is often called the city block distance because it gives the shortest path between A and B, each segment of which is parallel to a coordinate axis. So if you remember, perhaps from your computer science days, when you dealt with problems like the traveling salesman problem, how if a salesman has to visit many different locations, in what order should the salesman do that to minimize the overall amount of distance traveled? We use an L1 norm for that kind of a problem. That's also a linear programming problem. Airlines, when they're trying to figure out how to arrange their routes and their planes to sort of minimize the overall amount of gas consumption and distance traveled and such, we'll also use this kind of a norm. The Euclidean distance is an L2 norm, where k is equal to 2 here, so we just have essentially the sum of the squares. And people will also often look at the L-infinity norm. When you have the L-infinity norm, an interesting thing happens. That becomes the min-max approach. You essentially try to minimize the maximum deviation because the deviations here are going to be essentially raised to a very large power. So it's going to essentially the largest single distance of the components is going to dominate the overall distance. And therefore, if you solve a problem using this kind of a distance measure, then you will have you'll achieve what's called a min-max solution, which means you're minimizing the maximum distance. And that's also a very useful metric for a number of problems. And if you use this kind of a metric with dynamic programming, for example, and you vary the value of k, the order of this metric, you will get different optimal paths through your grid because the optimal path is only as good as the metric that you use to compute the optimal path. So within a dynamic programming framework, you can actually program this metric and then compute different solutions as a function of the order of the metric. Okay, so that's a little bit about metrics. And I think that concludes this section. So in this, so next what we're going to do is move into, I think this is the end of chapter 4 if I'm right, but if not, we're going to now talk about a new pattern recognition approach. So we're now going to build a little bit on this notion of distance and this notion of Euclidean spaces. And we're going to introduce a new class of pattern recognition algorithms based on risk minimization. And the particular algorithm we'll end up looking at, we'll look at two actually, support vector machines and something called relevance vector machines. But we'll spend most of the time on support vector machines. Support vector machines were first introduced probably in the early 70s. By the late 80s, people began to do some serious work with them. It took a while for people to understand them. And by the late 90s, they were fairly routinely used in many different pattern recognition applications. And they've remained pretty popular over the last 10 years, because they give you a very good solution to some very complicated classification problems. Did that... So let's first talk about what's wrong with generative models. So thus far we've essentially considered techniques that perform classification indirectly by modeling the training data, optimizing the parameters of that model, and then performing classification by choosing the closest model. This approach is known as a generative model because we're essentially training models based on supervised learning, and it assumes that we know the form of the underlying density function, which is not true in real applications. So in this model, we take a chunk of data. We will typically model it as a Gaussian mixture or some such model. And then once we've trained our models, we have a Gaussian mixture model for class 1, a Gaussian mixture model for class 2. We will then do classification based on the distance between these two models, between these two Gaussian models. Okay, is that clear? So what's wrong with that approach? Okay, so I think you hit on a couple good issues there. First, and I'll explain this example on the right in a moment, but if we have a data set that looks something like this, what is the Gaussian model for that kind of a data set going to look like? I drew the data set up in the middle top there. Well, we know that it's going to try to fit a Gaussian, something like that, right? Well, we sort of knew that. There we go. It's going to try to fit a Gaussian, something like that. All right, that's getting a little annoying. Let me try to work down here. If we have data like that, it's going to fit a Gaussian like that. If we have data, another similar data set, it'll fit a Gaussian like that. And then the decision surface is going to be drawn based on the properties of these Gaussians, not the properties of the original data, right? So the decision surface will be something, you know, something like that, let's say. But the equation of that line for the decision surface is a function of the distance between these two Gaussian models. So if these Gaussian models are not good models of your data set, then you're going to get poor classification performance because the decision surface is based on your ability to model those two data sets as Gaussians. So if you think about this long enough again, you can show that convergence in maximum likelihood does not guarantee optimal classification. And here we have a simple example of this. We have two uniform distributions, okay? Obviously not Gaussian. We modeled this distribution with a Gaussian. We modeled this distribution with a Gaussian. And we then observed that the optimal decision surface, the maximum likelihood boundary, is essentially going to be here where there's the crossover point, assuming equal probabilities and things like that. But where in fact is the optimal decision surface between these two classes? Well, obviously it's at the boundary of the two rectangles. So the maximum likelihood solution is not equivalent to what you might call the optimal decision boundary. So convergence and maximum likelihood does not guarantee optimal classification. Further, Gaussian maximum likelihood modeling, especially when you use Gaussian mixtures and you use large numbers of Gaussian mixtures, they tend to overfit the data. I mean, that's somewhat of a generalization, but it's true to some extent. It's been observed that these Gaussian mixture models very aggressively model the data, and you have a hard time controlling them from overfitting the data. Now, real data is often not separable by hyperplanes. So this is one concern. A second concern is that real data is not often separable by hyperplanes. So what does that statement mean? So what is a hyperplane in two-dimensional space? It's a line or a set of lines, right? In multiple dimensions, it's some kind of intersection between planes and you know, that multidimensional plane. So, but let's restrict our thinking to the moment, for the moment, in this kind of two-dimensional case. So what I've actually got a screenshot here of is the data set called Yin Yang in the Java applet. And that data set, you have one class denoted by the blue and the other class denoted by the red. And the distance, or the decision surface between these two classes is shown by the dotted line. That's the optimal decision surface. If you simply try to do principal components analysis to separate these classes, you'll essentially get a straight line decision surface. You can do class dependent PCA and get a little bit better. But you will have some error associated with this class. And so the question is, can we do better? Can we do better than separating the data by hyperplanes, better than using these generative models to classify the data? Well, when you as a human draw this decision surface, how do you actually go about doing that? Think about the steps in your mind that you go through when you draw that decision surface. Okay, very good. Very good answer. Now let's try to make that into an algorithm. How did you find, when you started tracing the line, what defined the points on the line that you traced? So which data points in this picture contributed to that decision, the construction of that decision surface, contributed most significantly to the construction of that decision surface? The ones on the boundaries, right? Very good. Do the points over here significantly contribute to that? No. So it should be possible to construct an algorithm that builds decision surfaces out of the points, the actual data points that define the boundary between the two classes. That, in a nutshell, is what is a support vector machine. How would we describe that in terms of pattern recognition terminology? Well, we would call that a discriminative approach, because this approach is not interested in modeling the statistics of the training data like a generative approach. It's simply interested in finding the data points that describe the boundary between the two classes. It's sort of like, if you think about maybe like the solar system, it's like going to the edge of the solar system. And then all you care about is the edge of the solar system. You don't care about what's interior to that surface. So if we could develop an algorithm to find the data points at the edge of the surface, at the edge of the decision surface, then we could actually create a function out of those data points that describes the decision surface. So it's sort of a hybrid of the K sub n nearest neighbor approach. We're using the actual data points to define the surface, but they're only data points that describe the discrimination between the two classes, not the overall statistics of the class themselves. So if you were to add more points here, that's not really going to change the nature of the decision surface. And that's a good thing, because among other things, that tells you these are the most important training data points, and I don't really care too much about the other ones. Now, what's wrong with this approach? No? Something more basic. We've touched on this topic a few times at the beginning throughout the course so thus far. Real-world algorithms have to be robust to many, many imperfections in the process of collecting and processing data. Well, what's one of the biggest sources of error when we're building labeled training sets? Particularly on the world's most important problem, speech recognition. What happens if a data point is mislabeled? So what's going to happen to the decision surface? It's going to build around that data point. So would you describe the technique that I've just described, what we're going to come to know as the sort of basic support vector machine? Would you describe that as a technique that's robust to errors in the training data? No, because it's going to do its hardest, it's going to work very hard to model each and every data point that defines that surface. So if you have a data point that's mislabeled here, it's going to try to build a decision surface around that data point. That could be very dangerous. So in practice, there are a couple very significant extensions to the support vector machine that allow us to be more robust to mislabeled training data, because our algorithms have to be robust to mislabeled training data. Secondly, what's wrong with a discriminative approach from a generalization standpoint? So, one of my examples I like to use on this is you're teaching your child about animals, and you show your child a person, and you show your child a dog, and you say, this is a person, this is a dog. Your child has a very good discriminative learning capability, so what does your child learn from that case? How? Well, how do they look different, though? What about number of legs? So you actually see this in children. So they'll assume, okay, people have two legs, animals have four legs. And then you show them a cat, and your child will say, oh, that's a dog. Because they've not been introduced to the difference between a dog and a cat. But you said, but wait a second, Dr. Bocconi, I trained a support vector machine on that training data, which was people and dogs. But then when you introduced cat, your algorithm is no longer working well. So what's the problem? What's another problem with this approach? How do we refer to that problem? The G word. Starts with a G. Generalization, right? Generalization. Yeah, there's a tendency here with discriminative approaches to discriminate aspects of your specific training set. And the extent to which that training set represents the real-world problem will then determine how general your solution is. So, in the early days of discriminative training, what we actually would do is to alternate between generative approaches and discriminative approaches. And we'll talk about this a little later in the semester. But we can actually do things like train Gaussian models and then run a discrimination algorithm that then tries to adjust the parameters using a discriminative training criterion. Then go back and do some more generative training, then go back and do some more discriminative training. And those kinds of techniques hybrid techniques have been used extensively. But support vector machines were of interest because they're a purely discriminative approach, and they give us a direct discriminative solution. And at the time they were introduced, it was one of the first techniques that really could do that. Neural networks is also a good example of a purely discriminative approach. So to deal with these very real problems that we discussed, issues like mislabeled training data, generalization, and such, we're going to cast the support vector machine problem in terms of a risk minimization problem. And I think that this is a very interesting point of view because it shows you that there's a whole class of algorithms out there. It's just a matter of how you define your performance metric. And support vector machines are just one example of how we define a performance metric. And I'll explain that in a moment. So to motivate this, we're going to use a concept called risk. Now, when I first started reading about risk, I thought got very excited, thinking, oh, great, this is sort of like maximum entropy. I mean, all of a sudden, it's like a whole new world. But, of course, then I very quickly realized there's entire industries that have been doing risk minimization for many, many years. Give me an example of such an industry. Insurance. The whole insurance world is built on risk minimization. As an actuary with an insurance company, your job is to assess risk. I don't know if you ever saw, my daughter and I watched this movie a few months ago, Ben Stiller movie, I don't remember what the name of it was, but he's an actuary in that movie. It's kind of a funny movie, and his expertise is estimating risk, so he lives his life and he's afraid of everything because he knows all the risk of opening the door and stepping outside your house in the morning and crossing the street and getting hit by lightning and all these kinds of things. But this isn't, in fact, what the insurance industry does. This is how they make money, is they assess risk, and then they make investments according to that risk, hoping that on the average, they will guess correctly and make money. Now, we've had, of course, a recent example of when that kind of a risk assessment fails, and that was, even before that. So prior to the financial meltdown, what's an example of an event? There have been several events in the last 10 years that have violated or taxed the limits of their risk models. And one big one, it hit Mississippi, Katrina, right? So what happened when Katrina hit? What basically happened to most of the insurance companies in Mississippi? They went bankrupt. Why? Because that was off the map in terms of their risk assessment. The amount of the Katrina was a, how often, what, how would, if you ask the actuary, how often should something like Katrina happen, what would they say? Once in, right, somewhere between 100 and 1,000 years, I would guess. I think it was actually more than a 100-year flood. And of course, global warming supposedly is changing this, but that's a whole nother. We won't get too political as I've in this class. But the problem with risk, of course, is when you're wrong, it can be catastrophic. And Katrina was an example that basically exceeded the capacity of their risk model, so a lot of companies went bankrupt. The financial meltdown's been another sort of interesting case, but it's not so, the financial meltdown's not so much. Well, in a way, it is about risk because, for example, there were a lot of bad investments on home mortgages. And anytime you agree to lend somebody money to buy a house, you're doing a risk assessment. What's the likelihood that they will pay that mortgage back? So we're going to today formulate risk in a general sense. And this approach is actually applied to many, many different disciplines. So the expected risk can be defined as, and we're going to call this capital R of theta, where theta are the parameters of our model. So the risk of a model, the expected risk of a model, is the integral of the distance between the actual data points y and some function of our input points x. That distance integrated over the probability of x and y. So we take the joint probability between the actual measurement and the test vector, if you will. So this y is essentially the class assignment, and this f of x comma theta is essentially your estimate of the class assignment. And we integrate that distance. We take essentially an expectation of that distance based on the joint probability density function between the data point X and its class label. So if your model produces the correct class assignment, this distance is zero and the expected risk is zero. If your model always produces the wrong class assignment, this distance is maximum and your risk is maximum. And then reality is somewhere in between. Now, does the insurance company actuary actually know this? Do you, as a pattern recognition engineer, can you actually calculate that R of theta? Why? The answer is no, which is correct. Why? Exactly. We don't know the joint distribution. That's sort of the underlying true distribution. We never really know that in a problem, in a real problem. In a synthetic data problem, we can know that. But in a real problem, we never know that. What is the only way we get to view this problem and get to estimate that joint distribution? You collect some data. So, in addition to the expected risk, we're going to need to define something called the empirical risk. Empirical risk is essentially what we observe for our particular data point. So the empirical risk is defined as the average risk over the actual L data points that we have. So we take the sum of Y's minus F of X's over the L data points that we actually have, and we call that the empirical risk. That's our estimate of the expected risk computed over a particular data set that we have. So this is what you can measure from some actual data that you have. This is theoretically what's achievable for the model that you're dealing with. Now, the innovation by Vapnik and Chervonenkis, which is sort of the the genesis of the support vector machine. And really, it opened, like a lot of good developments, it opened up a whole new field, if you will, and a whole new way of viewing problems. Much like in the 70s, mean squared error analysis opened up a whole new field based on models. And then eventually maximum entropy. It was generalized to maximum entropy. And then we had EM and things like that. Well, this is very in the same kind of category. What Vapniks and Chervonenkis showed is that the expected risk can be bounded by the empirical risk using some function f of h, where f of h is given by this rather complicated expression, and f of h is referred to as what's called the VC confidence. Where this, and it's a function of a parameter eta, which we will call the confidence measure, and that has a range from 0 to 1. Now, the derivation of this in the original, in Vapniks' work originally, it's a very extensive derivation. It's hundreds of pages in the textbook. So we won't go through that derivation in this course. But what I want to highlight here is the importance of this view. This says that the expected risk, which is something we can't compute, and the empirical risk, which is something that we can compute, are related by this bounding function, which we call the VC confidence. And what's more interesting is that depending on how tight you want to make this bound, you can define different types of learning machines. So it's sort of a question of how tight do you want the bound? How tight do you want the relationship between empirical risk and expected risk? And then that in turn will create an algorithm for you. And I'll elaborate on that in a moment for support vector machines. Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. And this H becomes the key parameter, because that sort of controls the complexity of your machine. And as you make your machine more complex, the tighter and tighter you can make this bound, the better and better performance you can get. But what the question we want to ask really is, for a certain level of complexity, what's the best that we can do in terms of getting the empirical risk to match the expected risk? Now, this was significant because you'll notice this is not mean squared error. This is not maximum likelihood. It's just a whole other way of looking at algorithms. The VC dimension, this parameter called H, is a measure of the capacity of the learning machine. And that's a rather abstract notion. But what that simply means is it sort of tells you something about the ability of your machine to model data, complex data sets. So if your learning machine has many, many parameters and can arbitrarily model very complex data sets, it's going to have a high H, and you're going to get a low error rate. If your machine is very simple, like a single Gaussian mixture, you're going to have a low H, and you'll not necessarily get high performance. So it's just a measure of what's called the capacity of the learning machine, and different algorithms can be compared in terms of their capacities. Okay? So the principle of structural risk minimization, or SRM, involves finding the subset of functions that minimizes the bound on the actual risk. So we're essentially trying to find the functions which minimizes the difference between these two. Optimal hyperplane classifiers achieve zero empirical risk for linearly separable data. Data that's, for example, in a two-dimensional space that can be separated with a line achieves zero empirical risk. That's one example of that's an example of a case where you can achieve zero empirical risk on that data. A support vector machine is an approach that gives the least upper bound on the risk. So support vector machines is an approach which essentially minimizes this function for a given value of H. And that was essentially the innovation behind support vector machines. So next class, we will talk more about the specifics of support vector machines. But I wanted today just to give you the philosophy, because this was groundbreaking at the time it was introduced. In fact, it took about 20 years for people to understand this. Okay, so we will have the exam at 1 o'clock in Simrel 130.